Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria every Tuesday at an undetermined time. Supposed to be 12. Happy Valentine's Day, people. This is the Valentine's Day issue of Cooking Issues. Call in all your questions live, too. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Here again with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez and the engineering crew in the other room. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
So, the reason I'm late today, literally, most of the time, my fault. Most of the time, my fault. Check this one out. I'm on the subway because I still haven't fixed my bike yet, mainly because I'm lazy. And I run, because I see the train coming, right? The J train, M train, whatever it is. I run like a lunatic, so I have a huge headache now, like almost like I'm going to like get an aneurysm or something like that. Jump into the car, door shuts, and then promptly sits on the platform for 20 minutes. They finally come on, open the door, and they say, "Hey, yeah, there's some lunatic. This is Valentine's Day in New York for you people. There's some lunatic walking across the tracks on the Williamsburg Bridge, like stumbling back and forth. Apparently, I don't know, some star-crossed idiot, like walking back and forth across the tracks on the Williamsburg Bridge. So there's no train traffic on the Williamsburg Bridge. And they don't open the doors to let us out. They trap us like sardines in a box. Thank God my son wasn't there because that's his worst nightmare on earth. So I had to run out and get a taxi so that I could talk to you fine folks today. Anyhow, happy Valentine's Day. Stas, what are you going to do for Valentine's Day?
I'm babysitting your kids.
Yeah, because I have to go work at Booker and Dax, the bar. And first of all, it's only till 10, and Nastasha's night doesn't even begin until 11. I should be getting the pity party because my wife is away on Thanksgiving. On Valentine's Day. I won't even see my wife on Valentine's Day. I don't get a pity party for that. And check this out, people. Today, Valentine's Day, is the 20th anniversary of me starting to go out with my wife. My first date with my wife was on Valentine's Day 20 years ago today. And I'm not even going to see her today.
All right.
There you go. See, I believe I deserved a pity party for that one. But, yeah, I used to hate Valentine's Day. I hated Valentine's Day so much. Like, the first 20 years of my life, Valentine's Day, worst day in the world. But, you know, ever since then, ever since I started going out with my wife, it's been a good day. Except today when she's not here. Rah! Anyway. Okay. Oh, by the way, I realized, I don't remember whether it was last week or the week before, someone asked a question on Japanese Western-style knives because they had a, I forget which brand it was, I don't know. I forget. But Japanese Western knives, which are sharpened differentially on two sides, like 30-70 and whatnot. And the question they actually asked me, I realized this morning as I was showering, I was like, they actually asked me, how do you use a steel with a knife like that? And I realized I didn't actually answer that question. I talked a million years about sharpening and different knife styles and everything, but never about how to actually use a steel. You can't. Don't use a steel on a knife like that because it's almost impossible for you to accurately steel it with the two different edge angles. What I would recommend, though, is something that back when I used to have sharp knives in my house, and that means before I had a babysitter who would use my knives, I don't know what the hell she does with them, juggle. I don't know what the hell she does. But I can't keep them sharp anymore, so I stopped trying. So my knives are now... I went from having, like, very, very sharp knives to having very, very dull knives. There's a cute kid, by the way, looking in the window of our radio station, pulling her hat on, staring at Nastasha. I think in horror. I think she's staring at Nastasha in horror. Anyway. So what I recommend to keep knives like that super sharp is the same thing that barbers use for generations for razors, which is get yourself a leather belt, like a leather strop, wide one. Hang it up somewhere in your kitchen and strop your knife. And that really helps to bring like a light bit of an edge back. You can either strop just with an oiled leather band, which is what I did, or use a super, super, super mild abrasive. But the reason it's okay is because you're going in the opposite direction than you would do when you're stealing, and so you're not going to dull down your knife. And it helps to knock a little bit of the like minor burrs that happen as you're cutting. So I would go invest in a strop. I love it. And plus, strops look badass. When you're stropping a knife, it looks kind of badass. You ever stropped a knife, Tim?
Nope.
No? You don't like strops?
I wasn't really listening.
Good, good. Well, it's good to see you're doing your job here, as always. Okay. Hi, Dave and Nastasha. A quick sausage question. I found some information on the Cooking Issues blog about cooking sausages directly in a liquid with a circulator. One thing the blog didn't mention is how long it takes to get an average-sized sausage to temperature in a 60 degrees Celsius bath. Additionally, what is the maximum amount of time that sausages should be held at this temperature before the quality goes south? Thanks, Matthew. Okay, well, that's an interesting question. I should think that the interior of the sausage, I mean, any reasonable size sausage, it's going to be done probably in 40, 45 minutes, something like that, if you think about it relative to an egg. If you actually want to measure it, you can use one of the programs like Sous Vide Dashboard that you can is available on your iTunes or whatnot, and you can check exactly, but within 45 minutes or so, the average size thick sausage should be done. Now, I would hold it for longer than that because the deal is typically you have some tougher cuts of meat in a sausage and you're tenderizing it via grinding. That's one of the reasons why you grind it, right? Well, if you hold it longer and longer, the meat gets more and more tender. So depending on what cuts of meat are in it, you could hold it for quite a long time at those temperatures, quite a long time. Now, I've never held a sausage longer than, 6 hours or so, but they were good at the end of 6 hours. The trick, remember, when you're cooking sausage in a liquid like that, is to have the liquid be so flavorful that you're not leaching flavor out constantly over time. I would not cook them for any longer than necessary in an excess of flavorless liquid. Or you could put them in a Ziploc bag with a small amount of oil and cook them forever. Not forever, but for a long time, hours, and they're just going to probably get better, probably not get worse, depending on what kind of cut of meat that you put into it. Anyway, does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's a good technique. I do that technique all the time. Everyone's like, I said this on the show before, but I bought some really cheap sausage and cooked it that way, 60 degrees, 60 or 62, depends. It's going to be a little pink at the center at 60, which some people freak out about, so you might want to do 62, depending on what kind of meat is in the sausage, and depending on whether the sausage is already cured. If the sausage is a cured kind of sausage, if there's any sort of nitrites in it, it's going to be pink anyway, and then you can cook it to whatever temperature you want, in which case I would do 60. If not, you might want to do 62. Depends on how people feel. Anyway, I bought this cheap chorizo, and there were people like, this is the most delicious sausage in the whole world. And I was like, it's a circulator. It's not me. Anyway, I had something else with that, but I forget what it is. Oh, yeah. Anyway, my brain's a little fried because I'm saying, like, we here at Cooking Issues haven't been burning the candle at both ends recently. We've just been taking the candle, throwing it in the oven, and melting that sucker down. You know what I mean? It's like years ago, it's hilarious. Like, I heard Drew Nieprant, the famous restaurateur, he was giving a talk somewhere. I forget where it was. I was attending the talk. And he said this. He said, people always ask me, how do you balance, like a family life and a restaurant life? And he said, you don't. Ha.
And you were like, I can do it.
Well, yeah, whatever. Anyway, funny. Okay, so here's the thing. Like, working at the bar until all hours of night, right? And then putting your kids on the bus in the morning is not work, right? So my brain, therefore, is not working. So if I'm a little frazzled today, folks, it's just because I'm stupid. Okay. Dear Dave and Nastasha, a friend of mine recently found out she has celiac disease and therefore cannot have any more gluten. I was attempting to create for her some of the homemade goodness that the rest of us get to enjoy, i.e. gluten, delicious, delicious gluten. But when looking on the internet, I found many conflicting suggestions for the use of xanthan and guar gum, as well as suggested non-wheat flour blends, tapioca, potato, millet, etc., without rhyme or reason as to the ratios used. Do you have any experience or advice for working with gluten-free breads, pizzas, or pastas? What changes in properties can I expect from different brands of flour? What is working in xanthan gum that is intended to replace the gluten structure? Thanks for any help. Alex from Florida. All right. Well, first of all, I don't have any actual experience cooking gluten-free because I haven't had any need really to do it, for my own family. And I cook occasionally. I'll cook some gluten-free stuff if I have someone specifically coming over to my house, but I've never done a thorough researching of it. But I do have some advice. The reason, look, here's the reason it it's tough to, and there's so many recipes out there, is that wheat flour, right, is fantastic stuff. And there's, and all of the recipes that, you know, we've been developing since time immemorial are based on the properties of wheat flour. So, you know, one of the properties of wheat flour is its flavor, right, which we have all come to appreciate. And the other one, the other ones are its gluten, which provides structure. There's a bunch of properties. And the issue with making a replacement for wheat flour is that no one grain flour or no one flour has all of the properties of wheat. So if you're trying to actually mimic a wheat flour product in terms of its texture, right, you're going to have to use a blend of flours, right? So that said, and I'll get to the guar and the xanthan in a second. That said, you know, a lot of people base the initial part of their recipe on rice flour, right? Because it's fairly bland, fairly neutral, right? And, you know, it's not that expensive. It's easy to obtain, right? But if you use it exclusively, then it tends to make kind of dense, leaden, gritty things. So they add other, you know, starches and flours to it, like tapioca, for instance, which is going to add some stretch because it's really kind of weird gluey stuff, add some lightness, or potato, which helps absorb, which helps keep things moist and also make things lighter. So it's a balancing act between choosing those different things. Now, when you go to add things like bean flours, which some people do, that's going to also add its own kind of holding capabilities, ability to hold bubbles and trap bubbles, which is what one of the great things about wheat flours, its ability, and this is what the gluten helps here, is the ability to hold bubbles and form a nice structure when things are baking. So each flour has this different thing. But if you're going to add bean flour, the problem is if it's a very light flavored thing, you start tasting the bean flour in it, and it's kind of gross. So if you need something sturdier and the flavor can be covered up, then you can use things like that. And if they can't, you have to use something more neutral. In addition, a way to hold bubbles is to make things thicker. So people add starches that help thickening. So they're adding things like arrowroot starch, even though it's quite expensive, right? A good thing I saw on the interwebs about this is from and this, what I like about it is just her opinion on what the different flours do. You go to Gluten Free Mommy, and she has a list of all the different base flours and kind of what her opinion on kind of what they contribute or don't contribute to particular mixes, including sorghum flour, white flour, white rice flour, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the one problem I have with all these websites actually is that they, look, if you have an issue, like you can't have gluten, then focus on that. But everyone also throws in a bunch of nutritional mumbo-jumbo about what's good for you and what's not good for you. I hate that. I hate thinking – and my kids even do this. I hate it so much. It's, my kids are like, is this good for you? Is that good for you? I'm like, it's all either good or not good for you depending on the balance of things you eat in your diet. There's no – there are very few things that are bad for you, and there are very few things that are good for you. You know what I mean? Like, if you ate only carrots, you would turn orange. You know, I told my kid that, and then he won't eat carrots. Freaked out about carrots. He thinks he's going to turn orange. I'm like, no, no, you have to eat, like, many, many sacks of carrots. But the point is, variety is the spice of life, my friends, and you want to eat a lot of different things. Do you know what I'm saying? Anyway, all right. So another issue on that. Now, so that's just the different ratios of flour and what the rhyme or reason is you want to get a balance that mimics the texture of wheat flour without having an overly assertive taste. Usually the tastes are beany. They call them beany, or kind of like, you know, weird, kind of like dusty, like, you know, like chickpea flour, or like, what's the black-eyed pea flour, things like that. Okay. Now, as for xanthan gum and guar gum, xanthan gum is used to replace the protein because, like protein, xanthan gum can form a gel and really hold a light gel, right, and really hold air bubbles well. So it's used directly as a gluten replacer. Guar gum is cheaper than xanthan gum, right, and the guar gum that you typically buy in the store has an awful kind of beany taste. So I hate using it in things like ice cream. There's really nice guar gum called Flavor Free Guar from TIC Gums that is very neutral in taste. But guar isn't really as good a replacer for gluten as xanthan, because xanthan has the ability to form a loose gel structure that holds bubbles during the baking process, whereas guar is simply a thickener. So I wouldn't replace I wouldn't say that guar on its own is going to do your job for you. But guar in conjunction with xanthan, guar can be used to replace some of the xanthan and make the xanthan a little bit cheaper. Another thing you can use if you're not like multiply going to make your life difficult is eggs. The protein in eggs is fantastic and easy to use. And so that the protein in egg white, and you know, I guess also an egg yolk, can help replace some of the gluten because it holds structure as well. So, you know, eggs, xanthan, guar, I mean, whatever. Then I came across a website that's actually pretty interesting, and apparently it's won a bunch of awards, Gluten-Free Girl and the Chef. And here's something that they said that's very interesting. Now, by the way, I have some issues with the site. For instance, I don't know whether it's the Gluten-Free Girl or the Chef who's writing this, because I don't know that much about the website. But, you know, they stopped using xanthan and guar. The recipe I saw from them, they use a lot of eggs because it's their opinion that they're having a negative reaction to the xanthan and to the guar. It could be that they're having a negative reaction to the guar. Guar is, you don't really digest guar. And so if you eat 8 boatloads of guar, it's like, you know, it's like eating a serving of colon blow. You know what I mean? And you're going to have some fiber issues. You know, it's like eating a whole boatload of fiber. It's going to give you some swelling and some poop. Yeah, anyway, but you know what I mean? It's like, so that can be an issue. The good thing about xanthan is I doubt anyone's actually having a reaction to the xanthan because you're using it in much smaller quantities than you would use the guar. So it has less stuff that can go in there and cause you to bloat and swell and poo and all that kind of stuff, all that good kind of stuff. Anyway, Gluten-Free Girl and the Chef, they don't use gum replacements like that. They don't use guar or xanthan, but they do use eggs. But they brought up an interesting point, which I hadn't thought about, which is, I always bake with grams. Always. 100% of the time, I bake in grams. That's not true. Sometimes ounces. But by weight. And by weight is obviously, everyone knows it's the best way to bake. And everyone in the world thinks that we Americans are small children in the kitchen because we use these dumb cup measurements to measure things out. And in general, we can get away with it because we're measuring the same thing over and over and over again. And even though we're plus or minus about 10% with our measurements, our recipes still work. I say we should switch away from using cups, not because of the accuracy, although that's great, but because it's really messy to measure with cups, and it's much easier to measure and to change recipes when you're using a scale. I mean, a scale is just the best thing to have. Anyways, turns out that these different flours that you're substituting in when you're making your gluten-free flour mix have radically different densities from AP wheat flour, and so if you switch to going by weight, your substitutions are going to be much, much easier. And so that is what I think a good recommendation from the Gluten-Free Girl and the Chef. Anyway, let's go to our first commercial break and come back with cooking issues. Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Jack, what was that?
That was the Pixies from Carlos.
That was some weird stuff, Carlos.
Yeah, man, that's what I was saying.
That's some weird, weird business. I mean, I know we're some weird people, but that's some weird, weird business. Call and order questions too. 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Pixies, that's what? That's Bjork?
No, no. Bjork was the Sugar Cubes.
Sugar Cubes. Yeah. Man, you know what? And that was my era. Like, I should, like, this should be on the tip of my tongue. But that just wasn't my scene. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was more Fishbone Chili Peppers kind of a guy. Yeah, anywho. Okay. The only reason I say that is because that's also weird. You know what I mean? Bjork. All right. I forgot to mention the gluten-free girl and the chef. Those guys also use flaxseed or chia seeds. You ever cook with that crap, Stas? You blend it with a liquid and it turns to like a mucilaginous goop. So they also use that as a structure replacer. But my point is this. If you're using a mucilaginous goop as a structure replacer, just use xanthan. Xanthan's a great mucilaginous goop, and you don't have to go grind up flax seeds to do it. My opinion. Just me. Okay. I had something else. Oh, yeah. So when you're dealing with the gluten-free stuff also, remember what you're using it for. A cookie doesn't need a lot of gluten. A cake doesn't need a lot of gluten. So there you're just trying to mimic the texture of a wheat flour stuff, not necessarily the super. When you really need the hardcore gluten is in a bread. In a cake, you want it to be fairly light. And this is another point that the gluten-free girl and the chef bring up, which is good, is that remember batters, recipes, a lot of times will tell you not to overmix, not to develop the gluten. And when you're dealing gluten-free, you don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. So in a cookie or a cake, you can just focus on the taste and the texture of the kind of starch balance, the flour itself, with just enough structure from the protein to give it some structure. And you don't have to worry about it holding air in the way of a bread would. So that's another reason why there's no one-to-one substitution, because you're trying to do different things with wheat flour depending on what you're doing. Okay, now, by the way, we got something in from Elliot Papineau. About stropping. Bob Kramer has a strop kit, so you can go online, look up Bob Kramer, and purchase a strop kit. Strops are really badass, I have to say. You look like you're gonna like Sweeney Todd, Demon Barber of Fleet Street, like you're gonna go slit someone's throat as soon as you start stropping. Like if you were stropping a knife behind your kitchen counter, somebody like, man, I'm not gonna mess with that dude. That dude's stropping a knife behind the counter. Equally, it doesn't have to be a guy, a woman. You know, when I say dude, it's kind of a gender neutral dude. Is there any sort of gender neutral?
All of your appliances, dude, are women.
What are you talking about? Not all my appliances are women.
Take her, make sure she's, when you're talking about the centrifuge, the rotovap.
You're a crazy lady. Okay. Elliot also has a second point, which is that if you need to find the edge of your 70-30 knife, you just lay it flat on a stone and raise it until you feel the edge. That's good. Or I don't know if I mentioned this, using a Sharpie on the edge, you can look and see whether you're being accurate to do it when you want to test your edge. Anyway, okay. He also writes in with a question, Elliot does, and says, whenever you get on the air, can you talk about the different sources of glutamate? I've been experimenting with various free glutamate containing products such as tomatoes, mushrooms, kombu, katsuobushi. And what's the best way to pair foods containing free glutamates? Well, that's a good point and interesting. I always find it hilarious when someone eats something that contains 8 boatloads of glutamate there, and then they say that they have a reaction to MSG. Nastasha.
Yeah.
I'm talking about you.
I know.
Anyway. So, I mean, the best thing to do is, like, so the classic, think about it this way. The classic pairing, classic pairing, obviously, is kombu, which has a high source of free glutamates, and katsuobushi, which has high IMP. Those two things go together and basically synergistically react to make, like, mega umami, which is why kombu and katsuobushi are so good together. And Nastasha hates, by the way, kombu broth.
I do.
But you like it once you add katsuobushi and turn it into miso soup.
Yes,
you just don't like the seaweed broth on its own.
Yes.
Anyway, so it's good
like
to
have cavity fillings.
What?
It tastes like cavity fillings.
Well, I wouldn't know. My teeth are fine. I don't have any cavities. I've never had a cavity, and I've never heard anyone describe it like that, so I'm sure you're being crazy like usual. Cavity fillings. Why would kombu stock taste like cavity filling? What do they make cavity fillings out of?
I don't know. Aluminum?
No. Aluminum?
You tell me if you
aluminum?
Know.
Aluminum.
I think so.
No, they used to be made out of a mercury amalgam, but they're not anymore.
It's aluminum, no.
No! Why would you put aluminum in your mouth? Crazy, crazy person. It's nuts. You know, people, seriously. Okay. So how do we get on that anyway? Oh, yeah. So when you're pairing things together, I mean, obviously, you know, it's good to add, I mean, I just throw a bunch of those things. I have to cook a lot of vegetarian stuff because a couple members of my family are vegetarian and they come over. So a lot of my sauces that I used to umami up by throwing in anchovies, because anchovies are delicious in everything. You could throw anchovies into just about anything. And I'm not talking about the white ones that, you know, everyone, like, you know, they love, like, the boca-ronas and stuff like that, which are great. They're great. Fine, whatever. But, like, you know, good old-fashioned salt-cured anchovies in the can are, like, you know, one of God's great ingredients. And they make almost anything taste better. Everyone says they don't like them, and no one has ever said they don't like them when it's mixed into a pizza sauce. Pizza sauce, good with anchovy, yeah? Stasha's nodding her head up and down. Salad dressing, good with an anchovy in it. Any of that stuff. You wanna umamalate something? Bang. Hit it in. You're done. Anyway. Umamalate?
Yeah.
Yeah, you heard it here first. Cooking issues, umamalate. But the point is, so, like, you know, you have to add other high umami stuff. Now, you can go and work on things like tomatoes, and yes, I use boatloads of tomato paste when I'm because it's like super concentrated tomato. Obviously, you use lots of mushrooms to get that meaty stuff up. Parmesan, these are, you know, all obvious, and you end up doping stuff back with a whole boatload of soy, right? The problem with me is that trying to get meaty and high umami flavors by just adding high umami ingredients like that, specifically soy and whatnot, really makes everything kind of taste the same. It makes all of the food have a similarity to it that you don't get from just, for instance, adding salt. So, like, I think I talked about this, like, you know, I don't know, a year ago or something like that. You know, a lot of companies are trying to lower the sodium content of their foods. And the only way they can, this is the world's worst term, and it shows how people think, but increase the palatability of the things that they make when they reduce the sodium. Isn't that gross? They're just like, we're trying to reduce the sodium, but keep the palatability. Just gross, right? It's like, not like we're gonna make some delicious stuff. It's like, you know, we're gonna make it more palatable. Anyway, so they dope it with a non-sodium form of glutamate so that they can keep the quote unquote sodium level low, and they do it using also quote unquote natural sources, which means that they'll take like eight tons of seaweed and turn it into a powder. Might as well just use MSG. Anyway, problem is when you dope foods with, specifically with, like, lots of free glutamates like that, they tend to then all taste like dashi to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've had that also happen too, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was tasting somebody's pasta. I think I mentioned this. I was tasting someone's pasta, and it was a fettuccine alfredo,
yeah.
Right? And which is what I call my wife sometimes, because it's like Jennifer, Jenna, Fred, Fred, Fettuccine, Fred, any whatever. Anyway, like everything I say in private when I'm not on the air is some stupid combination of crazy, dumb, random inferences. You know what I mean? Anyway, so Fettuccine Alfredo, I was like, this tastes good, but Fettuccine Alfredo is not supposed to taste like dashi. Am I wrong? Right? Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyways, so that's my feeling, Elliot, on that. Should we do one more commercial?
Sure.
Before I go on the one commercial break, I have to say this. My favorite Valentine's quote of all time. Last year, I was in the Rite Aid outside of my house, which is a pharmacy for all you people that don't know what a Rite Aid is. Nastasha hates them because she only shops at CVS. She literally
music.
Okay. She literally, last week, Nastasha had a root canal, right? So I hope she was high on Vicodin when she made this choice. She went out of her way to go to a CVS, even though they had a two-hour wait for the medicine. She could have got it in 10 minutes at the Rite Aid. She would 2 hours, like, out of her way, 2 hours wait for medicine because she likes to hold music better.
No.
Yes.
No, the store music.
Whatever.
Yes.
Whatever. That's hold. You're on hold.
Do you keep tabs on, like, the stores and what music they play? Really?
I know. Crazy, right? You know, put on your iPod, listen to whatever music you want, and don't wait 2 hours for your Vicodin, your antibiotics. That's my point. Anyways, I'm in the Rite Aid like a year ago, and they had the Easter decorations out right around now, and someone, a lady walks in, and she goes, Easter, it ain't even Valentine's over yet. Anyway, commercial break.
My name is Cupid Valentino, the modern day Cupid, and I just want to say one thing. Happy Valentine's Day. I don't think y'all heard, man. I just want to say Happy Valentine's Day. Every day the 14th. Can y'all dig that? Now, when arrows don't penetrate, see. Cupid press the... hear he straight for your heart now, and he won't miss you. But that's alright, y'all won't believe in me anyway, but when Cupid knocks at your door, you can't ignore me. There's no need to run. So happy Valentine's Day. Hey.
You cannot ignore the Cupid. By the way, I just looked out the window and Indy Jesus looks like he's having a fine Valentine's Day.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he can smile on Indy Jesus' face. You know what it takes to get Jesus to smile? You know? Anyway. Today's show is sponsored by The Modernist Pantry, supplying innovative ingredients for the modern cook. Do you love to experiment with new cooking techniques and ingredients, but hate to overspend for pounds of supplies when only a few grams are needed per application? Modernist Pantry has a solution. They offer a wide range of modern ingredients in packages that make sense for the home cook and enthusiast, and most cost only around $5, saving you time, money, and storage space. Whether you're looking for hydrocolloids, pH buffers, or even meat glue, you'll find it at Modernist Pantry. And if you need something that they don't carry, just ask. Chris Anderson and his team will be happy to source it for you. With inexpensive shipping to any country in the world, Modernist Pantry is your one-stop shop for innovative cooking ingredients. Modernist Pantry carries sequestrants, including sodium citrate and sodium hexametaphosphate. These ingredients act as a preservative and also mop up stray calcium ions, which is helpful when working with hydrocolloids that gel in the presence of calcium, a.k.a. sodium alginate and Calcogel-F. Okay, which is gel-N. Fans of cooking issues that place an order of $25 or more before next week's show will get a free package of sodium hexametaphosphate to play with. Simply use the promo code CI72 when placing your order online at modernistpantry.com. Visit modernistpantry.com today for all of your modernist cooking needs. Hey, and Chris Anderson, good for you for doing the sodium hexametaphosphate and not the sodium citrate. Sodium hexametaphosphate is the baller sequestrant. Sodium citrate is more of a buffer. Sodium hexametaphosphate, or SHIMP, as they call it, that stuff's the balls. It's good stuff. Oh, also, Colin, longtime writer in Colin, writes, because, you know, I always gripe about what's the difference between a home cook and an enthusiast. What are we talking about? So Colin writes in, regarding enthusiasts, you don't need to cook anything to play with hydrocolloids. Science nerds love that stuff, but some can't actually feed themselves. Thus, I believe, the distinction. Colin. Other topics, my wedding anniversary, which it's not my wedding anniversary.
No. What? That was my note to you.
Oh, I thought Colin knew my anniversary, and I was crazy. It's like, how's Colin going to know that? It's not my wedding anniversary. I got married in June. It's my anniversary of going out. Nastasha, you know what? Like, listen, Nastasha, when you put this stuff on there, put it, our comments in a different color, just so you know how this show runs. Like, your comments, when you write them, are in black, and my comments that I make to jog my memory when I'm yapping on the radio, I write in blue, so I can tell what's us and what's you. And the headline of your question I write in red. Not that anyone gives a rat's patoot. Okay. Now. What? I can't say patoot?
Other topics. You thought Colin knew.
I thought Colin was like, other topics. That's random. Okay. Okay. So we have a question in from Marvin Woodhouse saying, loves the show. I've been listening from Ireland and now Germany since day one. From Ireland to Germany.
It's pretty cool.
I wonder what they do, yeah. What do they do that they're moving from Ireland to Germany? I wonder, curious. Anyway, question one. I'm in the process of moving to Germany, and most apartments here do not come with kitchens, just a bare room with tiles and connections. So I'll be starting from square one. What's the must-have list of stuff in it if you were starting from a bare room? Nothing, not even extraction. That's hood for you and I in America. The kitchen will be about 20 square meters. So, Nastasha, look up what 20 square meters is in square feet so my brain can wrap my head around it. Okay, first of all, I know there's plenty of people here in New York City that wish their apartment came with no kitchen because it's just wasted space. How many people do you know that use their oven as a bookcase? I do, which is crazy. First of all, just a separate note. Anyone out there, never store crap in your oven, right? It just means that you have a mental imbalance or a problem.
Yeah.
Don't ever store stuff in your oven. It's just not right because it implies you're not going to use it. If you're going to cook, don't store anything in your oven. My two cents. So what's 20 square meters?
It's coming.
Oh, thanks, Google. Thanks, AT&T, with the slow Google. All right. First thing is first, as you mentioned, extraction. It's my feeling that a hunt like the biggest – it's eventually going to be seen as a health issue. right? For people who cook a lot.
215.2 square
feet. Oh, that's good. 215, so that's about the size of my kitchen. That's a good space. That's a good size space. I mean, it's small by suburban standards, but, you know, my kitchen's pretty comfortable at 200 square feet, right? Yeah, I could have 8 people cooking in my kitchen, but it's very well designed. Anyway, if I do say so myself. Extraction, a hood, is the most important thing. Everyone here is underdesigned in terms of their hoods. Home hoods suck. They're the worst. They're useless. Not useless, but they're of limited usefulness. I would invest in a really good fan vent that – this is illegal in the U.S. I don't know whether it is in Germany. Vent it straight out the window with a straight pipe, straight out the window. I purchased a large blower, and the hood itself doesn't need to be expensive. It's just a piece of metal. It's the fan that you need, a good fan. And bigger fans rotate at slower speeds and therefore are not as annoying as little fans that rotate at high speeds. So I would say that if you're going to spend your nickels, first of all, go with good hood. Secondly, if you're in Germany, I haven't checked it recently, but I assume it's similar to France in that the gas prices are relatively high relative to electric compared to the U.S., get induction. If you're going to be in this apartment a long time, then go ahead and get something that's built in. Otherwise, you can get really nice induction hobs that you can take with you when you go. In particular, some manufacturers now make front-back induction units so that you can mimic an actual traditional range by stacking induction units next to each other and having front-back on induction. So I would definitely go that way. If you want to go more permanent, you can get an induction, a regular induction over range. But the over things don't necessarily work that well. But I'll go separate. Get a good convection oven a good convection oven would be nice. Electric there as well. I'm assuming that electricity is going to be the best for you there in terms of cost. So, again, I really don't have any idea what you're going to... I'll tell you what I have in mind, which is about the same spot. I have a large oven that could take a full sheet pan. If you're going to cook, you wanted that. It's not necessary, but full sheet pan is, again, baller. I have 6 burners. You're probably not going to have that if you don't have extraction, especially if you're going to go induction. I also have a salamander, which you're probably not going to put in your place, but I love it, and a deep fryer next to it. I find that that combination, which I don't expect you to emulate, is I can cook, I can bang out like a small restaurant's worth of food in my kitchen without breaking a sweat, because it is the setup that you would have in a small restaurant kitchen. Basically, I have a fryer, a salamander, 6 burners, and a full sheet pan oven. Obviously, for me, it's important to have an espresso machine, but, you know, whatever. Since you're building this yourself, you can do some cool stuff. The coolest thing that you could possibly do is put foot pedals on your sink. Every sink in the world, in a kitchen or bathroom, should have foot pedals installed so that when your hands are disgusting, you don't have to touch the faucet. So I have hot and cold foot pedals on my floor, and my wife, who didn't think it was so important or such a good idea, she was like, really? Really? Now it's like, yes, really. You need that. Everyone who's used them loves it. And since you're installing from scratch, get the foot pedals. Don't skimp on your sink size. Sink size, you're never going to need to, you know, sink size is important, right? Mm-hmm. Don't you hate a tiny sink? Mm-hmm. What do you think? Yeah?
I hate tiny sinks.
Hates tiny sinks. Is there anything else? What do you think?
No.
That's good. Good recommendation. Oh, no, my iPad shut itself off. Yeah. Hey, Patrick Martins, founder of Heritage Foods, coming into the studio.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah, there he is. Oh, he's got some really nice orange corduroys that I now covet.
You covet.
I covet Patrick Martin's orange corduroy pants. Okay.
18 miles, baby.
What? What happened?
18 miles.
Of what?
In 2 days I ran.
Oh, Patrick ran 18 miles in 2 days. I don't know. That's not good for your knees. That's, you know, it's bad for your knees. You know, anyway. Okay, question 2 from Marvin. I have a badass Polyscience lab circulator model, 8812. And by the way, I couldn't find 8812. But the unit is so big that it's difficult to fit food around in the small bath it's designed to fit. I removed it from the lab bath, but there's no mounting bracket. Do you have any experience of mounting these things to or over a sink? I haven't actually mounted one of those to a sink, but you might want to look at this as an alternative. Some of those units, and I couldn't find your exact one, but I have one that looks similar to it, have 2 screws in the back of it, on the bath itself, that allow you to circulate in and out of that same bath. So you could literally just put hoses and circulate into a sink and put the whole circulator into a cabinet next to it. And I've done that many times. That's how I chilled my Rotovap, for instance. You just have to make sure you get the water levels relatively the same so that you don't overflow your circulator bath. But I would do that, or else you could just make a second – I mean, if you could weld, obviously you could do it. But you could easily mount one by just having someone cut out a stainless steel bracket with the same hole mounting pattern as the one that was in the bath, and then cantilever it over your sink. I would make it with wing nuts so that you could take it off very quickly without taking up too much space. But yes, it's definitely possible. But look into just using the bath as a holding bin so that you can circulate stuff in and out. Question three. I'm throwing a cocktail party next month to mark us leaving Ireland. Can you – what? I have a caller?
And finish up in 2 minutes.
Wait. I have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. This is Todd Bryant. Got a quick question for you.
Go ahead.
On following up on your knife discussion a couple weeks ago, how often do you use a steel on your knives?
Well, back in the day, on my German knives, I would use them pretty much before and after, pretty much all the time.
Okay.
Or when my strop was hanging, I would strop them before and after. I mean, it all depends on what kind of knife. So my German ones, I used to sharpen. Just not a quick one. You know, I wouldn't like go through the whole sharpening process, but I'd touch up the blades on the stone probably once a week, and then I'd strop and or steel every use. My Japanese knives, you touch them up every time you use them, basically afterwards. You know, and you know the real traditional Japanese ones, and the Japanese Western ones, I never had much of a knack sharpening them. I ended up not using them as much because I was not so good at sharpening them.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So just touch my before and after then.
How
do you know?
What?
All right. Then how do you know when it's time to do a full sharpening? Or you just do that automatically once a week?
Yeah, I would just do it automatically. Or if they start dulling out, or if someone picks up your knife and uses it for something inappropriate. You know, it's like you know when your knife is getting dull. You know when you can't bring it back and the tomato, you start having to push into it and you split the tomato. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just, you could do it by that. I find it easier if you just choose a time to do it. It depends on how much you cook, you know what I mean? But if you just choose a time to do it, then your knives are always going to be in fantastic shape. You're not going to get creep and start using a dull knife when it could be sharp. So back when I could have sharp knives in my house, I would just have a routine. And, every Sunday before I started cooking family dinner, I would just go through my knives and sharpen it. I used an Edge Pro, which was easy to set up because I could just keep most of my knives at a similar edge angle and I could rip through them pretty quickly. An Edge Pro is not a good sharpening system to sharpen one knife. It's good to sharpen your whole set of knives. You know what I mean? Because you have to set it up and all that stuff. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, you answered my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks a lot. All right, so question three, I got to answer this one again from Marvin. I'm throwing a cocktail party next month to mark us leaving Ireland. Can you suggest some interesting cocktails and canapé combos, or as I call them, canaps? I have an ISI, but no proper carbonation rig. I also have agar gelatin. I also need some non-alcoholic cocktails that are not lame, as there will be some pregnant ladies in attendance. Okay, well, I hit the non-alcoholic stuff. I say make coriander syrup.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you make coriander syrup, just make a simple syrup, crush up coriander, put it in there, add a little bit of like a hot pepper, preferably red, like Thai red or Serrano or something like that. That syrup makes a fantastic soda, and you can carbonate in an ISI. It's just going to cost you more. And the way you carbonate in an ISI is by shaking, adding some water, shaking the syrup with water, and then putting one CO2 cartridge in, shaking a little bit, venting that entire one off. You've cleared out all of the air in there. In that now put a second charger on, shake it, and you'll get a second CO2 charger in your ISI. Vent very, very – let it sit for a couple of minutes after you shake it. Let it vent very slowly, and you can get a decent soda, and that's good. That syrup is also really good as a cocktail for old fashions. It makes a great old fashioned, makes a good tequila old fashioned, good mezcal old fashioned. We've been using that in everything. That if you do make an old fashioned using coriander syrup, it's called a Cliff old fashioned because Cliff, our ex intern Cliff, came up with the idea of making a what's it called? An old-fashioned with that syrup. You have any – Nastasha's going to think of good canaps while I answer your last question. And if not, you have a – next month. I have a week to think – we have a week to think of your canaps. Canapes. So I'll come back to it. And also, I will next week suggest some things you might be able to use with your 1 kilogram of N-Sorbit that's in your kitchen. Listen, Marvin, if you have 1 kilogram of N-Sorbit in your kitchen, that's almost going to take up your entire 200-square-foot space, because 1 kilogram of N-Sorbit is a giant amount of N-Sorbit. N-Sorbit, for all that you don't know, is the stuff that you make oils into powders with. But I'll come back with you on that, Marvin, next week, and we'll do it. And that has been this week for Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.